You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
This episode is brought to you by Snapple. Want to know another Snapple fact? The first hot air balloon passengers were a sheep, a duck, and a rooster. Ridiculous. Check out Snapple.com to find ridiculously flavored Snapple near you.
We all know how important it is to keep your eye on the money, and not just your own. Stay on top of the latest financial and market news with Yahoo Finance, a podcast that releases new episodes almost every day. You'll hear a brief overview of the biggest news in the financial world, all in 3 minutes or less, right after markets close. Check out Yahoo Finance wherever you get your podcasts. That's Yahoo Finance wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Kick-Ass News. I'm Ben Mathis. Hey folks, I want to tell you about a new podcast called Outside the Box. If you're a maker, a doer, an innovator, or even just a consumer who wants to get a peek behind the curtain of some of the world's greatest organizations, you should check it out. The first episode features conversations with presidents and CEOs from organizations like the World Wildlife Fund, Feeding America, and more. And you can expect new episodes about things like corporate culture in the 21st century and inventive approaches to business with great insight from some of the brightest minds in the nation. Subscribe now, seriously, right now, to Outside the Box in Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. And now, enjoy this podcast.
I like people watching, mostly this one woman. Yeah. I'm doing them one at a time. Birds are one of the only other creatures who make their own houses, and they're one of the only creatures we make houses for. That is arrogant. What's that bird? That's a house? That's your house, huh? That's like a shitty patio at best. Come on. It's just some sticks in a circle. This is embarrassing. You want a house? Tell you what, I'll make you a house. It'll be like a little human house. There, a tiny little person house for you. I know you can fly, but I'm putting a roof on it. Tough shit, deal with it. A little hole that's too small for your body to try to get in and out of there. Birds are in the house like, I feel ridiculous. The other animals think we're trying to be little people. This is just really pathetic. Shut up, Lewis. It's a free house. One time on vacation, I went snorkeling slash surprise drinking a lot of water through a giant straw.
Hi, I'm Ben Mathis, and welcome to Kick-Ass News. That was just a sampling of comedian Dimitri Martin's unique brand of humor. Since I first heard him several years ago, he's become one of my favorite stand-up comics with his clever one-liners, his wry skew on cultural and social conventions, and his unique incorporation of his drawings and music into his act. After dropping out of NYU Law School to pursue comedy full-time, Dimitri Martin began making a name for himself in New York's alt-comedy scene. He caught his first big break in stand-up comedy when he appeared on Comedy Central's stand-up showcase Premium Blend. Then, at the 2003 Edinburgh Fringe Festival, he won the Perrier Award for his show If I, which was later turned into a BBC television special. From 2003 to 2004, he wrote for Late Night with Conan O'Brien, and in 2004, Martin had his own Comedy Central Presents stand-up special. Starting in late 2005, he was credited as a contributor to The Daily Show, on which he appeared as the senior youth correspondent, hosting a segment called Trend Spotting, in which he talked about so-called hip trends among youth, such as hookahs, guerrilla marketing, social networking, and Xbox 360. Beginning in 2009, he hosted two seasons of his own television show called Important Things with Dimitri Martin on Comedy Central. Martin starred in the Ang Lee film Taking Woodstock, which premiered at the 2009 Cannes Film Festival, and he's appeared in Flight of the Conchords, Contagion, The Rocker, and the Cartoon Network series We Bear Bears. He's recorded two comedy albums simply called Stand Up Comedian and These Are Jokes, and authored two books called Point Your Face at This and This Is a Book. Now he's making his directorial debut with his feature film Dean, which he also wrote, edited, and stars in, along with Kevin Kline, Mary Steenburgen, Gillian Jacobs, Reed Scott, Rory Scovel, and Briga Helin. The heartfelt comedic tale about a father and son coming to terms with love and loss as they find their way out of grief received the prize for Best Narrative Feature from the Tribeca Film Festival in 2016. Today, Dimitri Martin will talk with me about directing his first movie and how it was an outlet of sorts for his own grief following his father's death and his mother's slow fade into early onset Alzheimer's. He talks about lovingly lampooning L.A. in the movie, working with Kevin Kline, and how directing a feature film required him to rely more heavily on his own instincts than when he's doing stand-up. He also talks about giving up law school for comedy, how he came to incorporate his drawings into his act, and the kinship he feels with earlier comics who came before him. Plus, Dimitri Martin on fatherhood, seeing the world through his children's eyes, and how to make binoculars out of toilet paper rolls. Coming up with Dimitri Martin in just a moment. I'm delighted to be sitting down with one of my favorite comedians, Dimitri Martin, today. He's also an actor, illustrator, and writer. And now we can add the title of director to his resume with his new film, Dean, which opens in theaters this Friday, April 2nd. Dimitri Martin, thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
You have such a unique voice as a comedian and a perspective on the world that I'm almost envious of. You have some of the most perfectly constructed and succinct jokes I've ever heard in my life. My favorite, I think, is when you say, "I like people watching, mostly just this one woman."
Yeah.
It's a great example of what you do by taking very matter-of-fact observations and tweaking them just enough to completely change the meaning of the thing. And oftentimes, you're pointing out the most obvious thing that we as adults have either forgotten or overlooked. Growing up as a kid, did you have that kind of innate curiosity that children have and that oddly literal perspective on the world around you, or was that something that came to you later in life?
Let me think about that. I think I did to some degree, but I don't remember that being prominent where people said, "Oh, Dimitri's has
precocious,
an interesting perspective," or something. But what I was drawn to was puzzles. I really liked like brain teasers and those kinds of games that you find in some of those books where they're just collections of weird word puzzles and number things and patterns and stuff like that. So I don't know if that was the part of my head that eventually got me to jokes. I liked comedy when I started to see it on TV. This was in the 80s. But yeah, I think it was is maybe that kind of pursuit of solving little weird puzzles and problems that, you know.
Yeah, because oftentimes with these kind of brain teasers and these little puzzles, it's all a very simple matter of stepping back and just reanalyzing a particular word and realizing that
yeah,
there's another meaning there.
Yeah, I think so. It's yeah, that kind of stuff. And yeah, sometimes there's something really simple that's just like looking at it slightly differently and then something opens up or you find an answer, you know. And I think for me, when I started writing stand-up material, one-liners, that's what came out. I really started with jokes, and I actually have trouble getting away from that. It's like there's a gravity that like pulls me back to that kind of writing, because I'm trying to learn how to do longer bits on stage. And I have done one-man shows, I guess you'd call them. Like, they were for theater comedy festivals, like overseas, like years ago. It's been, God, 12 years, I think. 15 years since I did the first one. And those were autobiographical and I told stories. I put jokes in the shows, but that was an attempt at trying something a little different on stage. And I enjoyed it, but not as much as I like jokes. I really do like the game of jokes.
It almost harkens back to early comedy, like Henny Youngman, these one-liners. But it's got to be, I have to think, to fill an entire set with one-liners has got to be a huge amount of pressure.
It's tricky. What I find is the more I have behind me, the trickier it gets, because they're premises that I've used up or jokes that my head might end up there again. And I'm like, wait a minute, I think I've written that joke already, so I can't.
Yeah.
I can't do that. I improvise more than I used to, and I'm a little more present, I think, when I'm on stage. So that helps me fill material and time in a different way than just preparing stuff. But yeah, when it comes to, you know, the new stand-up special I'll do in about, I think, 8 or 9 months, I'll shoot a new one. Yeah, I'm building like brick by brick to get there.
Yeah, I think somewhere I read that you nowadays improvise a lot more just because you get frustrated by assholes who show up with their cell phone or whatever and go and tweet your joke when you're still working on a bit.
Yeah, I've learned not to look on Twitter anymore because it just upsets me too much. But yeah, it would be like I try a joke for the first time and then it's been tweeted by a few people. Granted, the world doesn't care, but when you're trying to figure out your jokes, it does mess with your head a little bit because you're like, God, that's not ready yet. Like, I'm trying to work it out. And even if it were, you know, give me a shot at telling it a few times before you take it.
Are you on Twitter now? I know for a while you weren't.
Yeah, I'm on there. Reluctantly.
How's that adjustment?
I don't enjoy, personally, I don't really? Enjoy social media very much. I don't.
But it's built for one-liners.
Kind of,
yeah. I would be just, made for you.
I guess, but people just devour the material and, and then it's just kind of gone. And also, people, they correct you and comment on your jokes.
Trolls,
and it's just all that shit. I don't have it too bad, but I've learned to just avoid it, and then I seem to have a better life.
Mm-hmm. Well, I read that you were going to law school at NYU when you got bit by the comedy bug and started doing stand-up. I imagine that you probably tested the waters a bit and did some open mic nights at first. When was the moment when you fully committed and decided to focus 100% of your energy on comedy?
Well, weirdly, and I don't know if this is just looking backwards, but from the beginning, I decided that I was going to do it before I got on stage. Mm-hmm. I didn't know how I'd make a living doing it. I didn't know if stand-up would be something I could actually do as a career. I wanted it to be something. But I thought, well, maybe that'll work if I'm good enough at it. Or maybe I can get work as a writer if I can figure out how to do that. But I remember thinking, I'm going to find a way to make a career in comedy because I liked joking around with my friends and I liked comedy a lot. And I was kind of lost in law school. It wasn't a good fit for me. And I was suddenly wondering, what am I going to do with my life? And, you know, in a very literal kind of unimaginative way, I just thought, I remember sitting down and thinking, okay, what do you like spending your time doing? What do you find validating? What makes me feel like I like myself or something? And okay, so I thought that through and then I was like, all right, now how do you get money for doing that? How can you make that a job?
That's the catch.
And that was the trick, yeah. So that was the game for me. And so of course it took me many years to achieve that, to get it to be a job.
Mm-hmm.
About 7 or 8 years of temp jobs and proofreading and clerical work and different kinds of jobs that enabled me to do stand-up at night for free, basically, until eventually I got there.
Well, yeah, as someone who goes around questioning established norms and picking apart the semantics of things, it's hard for me to imagine you going into a court and just annoying the crap out of a judge.
Yeah, I think that wouldn't work well for anybody. Yeah. I think what drew me to law school was some of the, when you talk about how the law is shaped over time, like the history of jurisprudence and different fact patterns and how they're similar or different from each other, there's definitely something interesting about that to me. But in practice, the thoroughness that's required,
yeah,
it's just a very grown-up, detail-oriented kind of job that, not for me.
Are you the kind of guy who resists wanting to be a grown-up?
Yeah, yes and no. I've always wanted to be taken seriously kind of as a grown up. I have looked younger than my age in the past. I think that's leveling out now and I'm starting to look more my age. But yeah, sneakers and hoodies and my haircuts probably didn't help along the way. But sometimes I felt the opposite, like, hey, I'm an adult and, you know, I have something to say here. And then other times, yeah, I think I don't want to solidify into being a grown up too much.
Yeah. Well, along the lines of being taken seriously, early on you got labeled as an alt comic.
Yeah.
Nowadays, you know, we think of alt comedy as where the really interesting stuff happens. But at the time, were you a little bit resentful about being put in that box and limited like that?
Not really. I think it was funny even at the time to me and some of my friends, because there were, in New York, the comedy clubs and then other rooms. I started in 1997, and that was not a boom time for comedy. It was it was the tail end of, I guess, what you'd call the bust, kind of in the early 90s into the late 90s. So stage time, it's always precious, especially to beginning comics, just trying to get on stage to figure out how to do your act and figure out your voice. But at that time, it did feel like it was really hard to find good stage time. So the clubs were the clubs, and they're still there. Those who got stage time in the clubs and who did, you could call it club comedy or kind of straight up stand up, whatever you want to call it. You know, some of those guys would act like me and my friends who did spots in the other rooms were weird or doing alternative comedy. Some people were trying weird things in those rooms, but I mean, like you were saying about Henny Youngman, I always thought that what I do is more old fashioned than a lot of the club guys. I think a lot of those guys at that time, what they were calling comedy or club comedy, with some distance and over time, when I saw it, especially after traveling, going to the UK, Australia, and around America, I realized, well, no, they were doing kind of an 80s form of comedy that a lot of us saw on TV when we were growing up, but then this became sort of a norm. But getting to know some comedians who predate my generation, like Albert Brooks and some guys I've talked to, I learned quickly, oh, they were doing what these guys are calling alternative comedy before these kind of mainstream guys were doing their 80s comedy. So it was funny. Even at the time, it was like, I don't think this is alt, really. It's just, if I could get the club stage time, I'd take it at the time, but I couldn't get it.
Mm-hmm. Your illustrations figure heavily into your stand-up and also into your new film, Dean. Which came first for you, the drawings or the comedy?
Well, when I was a kid, the drawings were there. Not as you see them now, but stylistically, I'm not very different than I was as an artist, I guess you'd say, when I was a kid, because, you know, I'm not trained or anything, so I can draw a little better than what I do in the movie and on stage, but it takes me a lot of work.
Yeah.
I kind of don't have the patience for it.
Yeah.
And there's a little more life in the drawings, especially as they communicate an idea. Usually I'm just trying to deliver a joke or, you know, a little idea with a drawing, so it doesn't need much more, I find. It's kind of like one-liners where I like not having too much excess. It doesn't need too much ornamentation. I usually don't draw faces on the people. I just need the position, kind of the body language, you know? And I like that about it.
Yeah. But the question is, can you draw hands?
I can draw hands, yeah.
Everyone says hands are the worst.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I can draw hands in certain positions, but I'm not an expert at hands. But I drew as a kid and I liked it. And then I kind of stopped. Just, I guess, other interests took over, you know, and middle school, high school, college. And then it was only after I dropped out of law school and started doing stand-up that I found myself drawing again, because I had a notebook. Usually I would have a notebook with me, and I still do usually. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I still like to write jokes by hand often. I write them on my computer, and sometimes I text myself a joke in the phone. But it's enjoyable, and I feel like I get different kinds of ideas if I take a pen and actually write out sentences and write out ideas.
Mm-hmm.
And then once I have the pen and the paper there, that kind of lent itself naturally to doodling. And then I start to realize, oh, wait a minute, some of these ideas work better as just a visual scene, like a snapshot or a single panel. And then I found, oh, I have this other leg to stand on comedically here.
Yeah, and your character in the film carries around a pad of paper and a pen as well to write down ideas. So that's something you still do. You haven't succumbed to, like, the iPad or using a smartphone for that sort of thing?
Yeah, I feel like I lose degrees of freedom as soon as I need, like, a plug, you know, that kind of stuff. Even on planes, I have a Kindle, but I do like paper books. It's nice. I don't have to turn it off. I'm allowed to read it the whole time. Nobody can make me do anything with it. And there is a feeling of freedom there for sure.
You know, incorporating your drawings into your comedy must have seemed sort of risky when you first tried it, because you either have to slow down the pace of the joke to allow your drawing to catch up, or you have to speed up your drawing to keep up with the joke.
Yeah, I think that's always part of the puzzle for me. When I first put drawings on stage, that was a fun experiment to see, hey, can I get extra punchlines or a different punchline on a joke here and have an audience member's kind of perception of the joke morph or, I don't know, change or something. I don't know what the word is, but, you know, could I just play with that a little? And it, you know, mostly worked. It was kind of cool. And then when it came time to make the movie, I thought, yeah, let me make my character a cartoonist or an illustrator, and then I'll have something else to share with a viewer as I tell this story, another way to show them what the guy's going through and take them on a different journey and almost have like a silent film that's told in just drawings running alongside the main narrative of the movie or with it. And, you know, I shot it widescreen, kind of old-fashioned. Yeah. That gave me a little more real estate so I could put the drawings up there when I split the screen, do those kinds of things.
Yeah, and that's one of the things that I love the most about the movie is because someone who's familiar with your work is going to be very happy with this film because it's still the same offbeat type of humor. You even, like you said, incorporate the illustrations into it, but you've added some new layers, some depth, some personal emotion that I guess reveals a deeper level to you that people probably haven't seen from your stage work.
I think that's true. That's something I was hoping for. I think as a movie fan and a guy now who's in his 40s, you know, I'm drawn to, I guess, more emotional stories. Mm-hmm. And that seemed important to me, certainly as a first time here. Could I tell a story that was more personal and dealt with something a little deeper than usual? I don't know if deep is the right word, but heartfelt maybe is the word. And my stand-up is really personal, but it's more about, I guess, what I think about, not so much what I feel usually. But with the movie, I thought I had an opportunity here on a movie screen, or I guess if you watch it on your phone, it kind of works. But, you know, the fantasy is that people would see it in a movie theater the way I still like seeing movies when I can, because there's that immersion and intimacy with the characters and with the story. And as a director, you have all these opportunities to tell your story in all these subtle different ways and, you know, get in close, show people wide, two people together over the shoulder, the drawings, some music. So I thought, wow, if I have all those tools at my disposal, it would be really great to try to tell a more emotional story and at the same time have it be fiction. So I wanted it to be emotionally autobiographical, but I don't want to tell my life story. I don't know. I'm not drawn to that. You know what I mean? I don't want it to be a memoir. Yeah. I want it to be fiction.
We're going to take a quick break, and then I'll be back with more with Dimitri Martin when we come back in just a moment. In today's digital economy, customer experience is the new competitive edge. And the Couchbase Engagement Database is the only database specifically designed to deliver the brilliant experiences that keep modern customers coming back for more. Old-school transactional and analytical databases can't deliver the exceptional experiences customers expect today, much less the ones they'll demand tomorrow. Only Couchbase Engagement Database is designed to deliver ever richer and more personalized customer experiences as your business innovates and grows. It supports millions of interactions while easily adapting to changing business requirements. It's always on and always fast with consistent high performance and built-in fault tolerance. It keeps your data secure everywhere. It has built-in smarts for highly personalized engagement. It's right at home on premises, in the cloud, or as a hybrid. And it gives users a seamless, amazing, and always-on mobile experience. Ready to revolutionize your customer experience? Learn more at couchbase.com/kickassnews. That's couchbase.com/kickassnews. HelloFresh is on a mission to save home cooking. Their meal kit delivery service makes cooking more fun so you can focus on the whole experience, not just the final plate. Each week, HelloFresh creates new delicious recipes with step-by-step instructions designed to take around 30 minutes for everyone from novices to seasoned home cooks short on time. And they source the freshest ingredients measured to the exact quantities needed so there's no food waste. They even employ two full-time registered dietitians who review each recipe to ensure it's nutritionally balanced. For less than $10 a meal, HelloFresh delivers delicious food right to your doorstep in a recyclable, insulated box. I've tried out HelloFresh for myself. The recipe was easy enough that even I could follow it. It only took 30 minutes to cook. The ingredients were fresh, and most importantly, it tasted terrific. In fact, I liked it so much that I gave HelloFresh to my mom for Mother's Day, and now she's hooked on HelloFresh too. HelloFresh is now offering light spring meals and has just introduced breakfast options. And for $30 off your first week of deliveries, visit HelloFresh.com and enter KICK30 when you subscribe. Again, that's HelloFresh.com and the offer code KICK30 for $30 off your first order. HelloFresh. Get cooking. And now, back to the podcast. You dedicated the film, in fact, to your parents. I think their names are Lillian and Dean.
Yeah.
Your father passed away a few years ago. Your mom has been dealing with early onset Alzheimer's, which is a form of loss in its own way.
For sure.
The film deals with a middle-aged man grieving over the death of his mom and thinking about his own mortality. Was writing this movie in some ways therapeutic for you?
Yeah, I think it was therapeutic. Writing the movie had its own, I guess you'd say, therapeutic aspects to it, working out some of the conversations, even if they weren't real conversations that I specifically had. I took from moments in my own family's experience, losing my dad and, my mom getting sick. So that was interesting, for sure. And then editing it was a second wave of that feeling of dealing with the issue, thinking about it and talking about it at first. And then the edit just took a while. And then it turned into just trying to solve the movie just to get it to work. And then I forgot about that stuff. And then I get to see my face more than I ever wanted to, you know, just like stuff like that where I was like, oh boy. So then there was like a new grief. This is a self-hatred, just an extra wave of that. I was like, oh boy, this is, what did I get into here? So then I got used to that, and then eventually it was, all right, I think I have a story here, you know.
Your character in the film dwells on death quite a bit in the wake of his mom's passing away. Are you someone who finds yourself thinking about death a lot?
Yeah, I am. I think that's a very honest part of the movie for me, for sure. My wife teases me because if I'm working on a new stand-up special or when I did my first book of drawings. I'm going to have a second one out in September, which I'm excited about. It's called If It's Not Funny, It's Art. But whether it's drawings or jokes, she'll say, you know, you have a little too much death material, I think. Pick your three favorite death jokes. You know, you don't want to bring people down too much. Or pick your, you know, three or four favorite death drawings and go with those. But don't, you know, that's her advice. She's like, I just think it's a lot of death stuff for people. And it is funny. You go see some guy do stand-up on a Friday night, and he's got a whole section about death. You know, it's not like people don't think about it, but...
Right.
But yeah, it's
everyone
just not...
Everyone does.
Everyone does.
But they keep it to themselves,
they usually,
which
yeah,
is different.
More so, yeah. But yeah, it's there pretty often for me.
Well, I wonder, when I watched this film and your character's fixation on death, along with the way you portray interpersonal relationships, the way things don't always resolve the way you think, or the guy doesn't always get the girl, I kept reminding myself to ask you today if Woody Allen was a big influence on you as a first-time director.
Definitely, yeah. I'm a big Woody Allen fan. Albert Brooks, Alexander Payne.
Mm-hmm.
Wes Anderson, although I can't, with all these guys, I can't execute, even if I wanted to be like one of them, you learn quickly, especially with a low budget movie and your first one, you're just trying to get through it. And that a lot of my illusions about the stylistic things I thought I could do, they went out the window pretty quickly because it was a 20-day shoot. And it was just like trying to get the movie.
That's a race.
It was crazy. Yeah, I was just shooting a lot every day. So I had some ideas that I could execute, but some of the things I realized, oh, that's not going to happen. I don't have time to light that. But Hal Ashby was a big influence on me, I think, for this. I don't know. I don't know who's a direct influence. It's hard.
Yeah.
It's interesting when you try something new and you really don't know a lot about the technical terminology or you know, I didn't go to film school, so I don't know what I'm supposed to know and not know.
Right.
But as a film fan and as a comedian and a storyteller, you know, I had ideas. I'm like, cool, I want it to kind of look like this, and this makes sense. I think the camera should move here for this reason. You know, I had ideas about why I thought things should happen, but
yeah.
But once I thought more about that, it was the idea of an influence specifically. It's funny how much it recedes because mm-hmm. I don't have the skill set to mimic
yeah.
well enough, if that makes sense.
Yeah, because it definitely captures your voice. Well,
yeah.
No one would mistake a Dimitri Martin film for anything else.
No, it's true. It's interesting. I think maybe when you're new at something
mm-hmm.
or you've been doing it a really long time, maybe, I don't know. I'm just thinking this through now, but there's something about the constraints of, you know, time and money and ability, or if you've been doing something for long enough, in those two situations, I can see how it's really hard to escape yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think if you've been doing it for a long time, there becomes this exhaustion or something of possibilities, and you end up with yourself
mm-hmm.
because you can't keep up whatever you think you're imitating or who you want to be. You're just you. And I think in the beginning you can try, but at least for myself, you can't, you know, it's just like, you just don't have the resources. It's
yeah.
just like you're left with yourself. You start with yourself.
When you were writing the film, were there bits or material that you maybe tried out in comedy clubs and then later worked into the script for Dean?
A couple of things.
Really?
There's the baby silencer thing. There's a drawing in the movie where I talk about that. That's an old stand-up bit. So I thought, hey, that fits. There were some that I tried to put into the dialogue, and I don't know if any of those really stayed, but there were a couple that just didn't work, you know, either on the day I felt like, this is shoehorned in here, forget it, or, you know, I tried the joke and then looked at the various takes I had of it, usually 3 or 4 takes. I didn't have many more than that for most of the scenes.
Yeah.
And then I'd say, it's not getting a laugh, or it doesn't feel funny, it feels forced. So again, that kind of pushed me more towards more myself, I guess. In life, I think of jokes and I say them sometimes, but, you know, my stand-up is such a compressed version of it's a distilled version of some of my daydreams. But I don't walk around spouting off too many one-liners. If I think of them, I usually keep them to myself because...
Yeah. Well, people steal them.
Yeah, well, I don't want to be that guy who, you know, you hang out with him, he says something funny, and then you see it in his act, and you're like, ugh, was he doing material at that dinner party?
You're a guinea pig.
Yeah, so I just keep it to myself. Usually jot it down in a notebook or something.
Along those lines, was it hard for you to go from working as a comedian where you get an immediate response from the audience to working on such a big project where the payoff of an audience response is so much farther out in the distance? And perhaps you have to rely a lot more on your own instincts as a director.
Yeah, it feels like working in a vacuum, mm-hmm. certainly compared to stand-up. You have that immediate feedback in stand-up, and you have really honest feedback. Every crowd's different, but each is honest. And whether it's 10 people or 5,000 people, whatever it is, they're giving you in real time clues about what works and what doesn't, and how they see you comedically, mm-hmm. what you have to offer people, what they think about you, even if it's different than what you think about yourself. Yeah, then you go make a movie and, you know, you can get a laugh on the set maybe for this piece or that, but then it's still different anyway on the day in person.
Yeah.
Context is different, what's been going on that day, you know, whatever. And then you get to the edit and you see stuff on the screen. It's a whole new bag, you know? And then over time, of course, you can imagine.
Yeah, because it's been 3 years, right?
Yeah, you lose objectivity. Yeah. We shot it 3 years ago. I did a 35-city tour and a Netflix special during the edit, so that didn't speed things up. It premiered a year ago at Tribeca, and then CBS Films, they acquired it, which was great, but then they've held on to it, figured out their strategy, whatever, so... There was the election. I'm mm-hmm. guessing, you know, I haven't asked them. I'm guessing that's part of it. Was like,
this wasn't an election year movie?
Yeah, this does. This you could see this. And even now, I hope people find it, but it's a small indie, you know.
I think they will. It's exactly the kind of movie that I look forward to in the summer, which actually is oftentimes usually a Woody Allen movie.
Yeah, right.
The movie that I don't see coming necessarily.
Right.
That surprises me. I think people will really be pleasantly surprised with it. Your character in your film takes sort of a New Yorker's fish out of water perspective on Los Angeles and the entertainment industry.
Yeah.
you, of course, had your own show on Comedy Central. You've worked in writers' rooms, gone through the studio pitch process. How much of that worked its way into your take on L.A. in this movie?
I started with some of that stuff, having been a New Yorker for 14 years. My parents are from Brooklyn, but I grew up in New Jersey. I got to go to New York a lot as a kid, but I didn't live there. But once I got to, once I finished college, I chose to go to law school in New York, and then I stayed there after I dropped out, and, you know, mostly because I love the city and I love doing stand-up. It's a great place to start, and it's still a place I love to go. It's easy to love New York.
Yeah.
But then I did move to California. It's been 8 years now, I think. And so I think that's a pretty typical story for sure. And it's definitely well-traveled territory, narratively, comedically, whatever. But what I found interesting was what happens when you have an idea about a place and then you leave it, or you have an idea about a place and then you move to it. And do you fall for someone there? Do you have friends in the old place? Yeah. Do you make friends in the new place? Your relationships really do change the lens that you see it through. And that's not a big theme in the movie, but it was something I wanted to play with and deal with a little bit, so that I thought there was something I could add to that conversation.
Yeah, and one of my favorite parts of the movie is you kind of make fun of the New Yorkers who come to L.A. and just hate on Los Angeles the whole time.
Right, hate on L.A., yeah.
I swear, I've met that person so many times over the years.
Yeah.
And that scene was so spot on.
Yeah, I know. I think there really is, there is something from both angles for sure to play with. And it feels like, and maybe it's just my personal experience, but it does feel like it's changed too. I don't know. It feels, maybe because a lot of my friends have moved to California. Mm-hmm. The New York that I knew was populated by, it was a lot of the people was part of what I knew about the city, and they moved here, a lot of them. So that's weird. They're not there. Yeah. I go back, you know, I see people here and I associate them with New York, but they don't live there anymore.
Yeah. Well, you also have a wife and kids now.
Yeah.
And so you have roots here that I imagine helps you.
Yeah. And my kids are from California, which is weird. So,
yeah.
So that's a whole other story now.
Well, you know, much of this film deals with fathers and sons, and you're now, like I said, a father of two children of your own. Is their own curiosity and their sort of innocent point of view an inspiration or a resource for you creatively?
Yeah, it is. I think I was just talking to my wife about this, and I realized for us, one of the wonderful things about having kids is that it's an opportunity to be creative, just to be creative, just to play with your kids and to hopefully inspire them and be inspired by them. And, you know, there doesn't even have to be a big agenda there, but just making weird things and doing drawings and paintings that, you know, even if they end up in the garbage, it's just kind of fun. It's really inspiring, and it's not even a direct, you know, maybe I'll get material out of it, but I'm not even looking for that. It's nice. It's there's something very pure about it.
Yeah. You have a terrific cast for this movie. As a first-time director, were you surprised that you were able to land Kevin Kline and Mary Steenburgen as your supporting players?
I was, I was legitimately surprised. Yeah. I was delighted.
Because, you know, he's known as Kevin Decline because he always passes on
I
projects.
I know, and it's funny. People told me that along the way, so I really didn't get my hopes up. But he responded to the material. He responded to the script enough to agree to have lunch with me. So I flew to New York and had a lunch meeting with him. And that led to, it took a month or two, but after that he did say, yeah, I'll do it. And then once he came on board, it did really change the project, which was, you know, I was thrilled about. It gave it more legitimacy and it, you know, felt much more like a real movie.
Mm-hmm.
And even now, I think it is a real movie, you know?
It
and
is.
He's, well, and he's a large part of it.
It's got an opening date, so I hope so.
Yeah, and he's a big reason why the movie even got made, because the financing, you know, this one guy who financed it from Canada, or about a little more than half of it, he said, if you get Kevin Kline, you know, I'll give you this money.
Really?
So it's pretty direct.
And what's he like to work with as an actor?
It was such a treat, and I felt really lucky. It's funny, you go into it thinking, God, if I could get Kevin Kline. Well, then you get the person you wanted. Well, they're a human being. So now, you know, how's that going to go? And, you know, I feel like I got really lucky. I got lucky that he said yes. And I got lucky that he is the way he is. And he was gracious and collaborative. I learned a lot from him.
Really?
Especially in the edit, just watching his choices and what he did as an actor. It was really really cool and not something I thought I'd be learning. That wasn't on my radar going into it. You think, okay, I'll probably learn about this. I'll learn about lenses, getting through the day, managing people a little bit, working with actors, finding a scene together.
Yeah.
But then having the benefit of being in a scene with someone, being there on the day,
mm-hmm.
and then going into the edit a couple months later or whatever, and then seeing, you know, you remember, oh, yes, I remember that day. I remember this take. And then seeing the magic of movies, of a real movie star like Kevin Klein. I sat across from him. I saw him do that. And now I see it on a screen and I'm like, wow, look at that. Look at it. The way he, you know, he moves his face and stuff. They're just great instincts, talent, experience, whatever it is.
Yeah.
A guy like that, it's like, I don't know. It was really cool. And the fact that he was nice and has become a friend and his family, they've been very sweet to me and my wife and kids. You know, it's just a total bonus.
Yeah. Now, as a comedian, you're usually writing for one character yourself.
Yeah.
Did you find it challenging to relate to and write dialogue for older characters like Kevin Klein's character and Mary Steenburgen?
Yes. I'd have to say it was challenging to write for everyone who wasn't myself. And it wasn't that easy to write for myself because I was trying to put me into scenes. And I usually just, it's like walk around back and forth and just say some thoughts I had. That doesn't work in a movie. So, of course, I had to think about what the character wanted and how I could create a story and some dramatic tension and some sort of a narrative. But yeah, writing for people who are older than I am, women, which I am not, those were challenges because I wanted it to be authentic or to at least feel real. And I didn't want everyone to have my rhythm either. It's not like everybody can, you know, you don't want them all talking the same.
Right, right.
So there's just like simple mechanics you want to make sure you can figure out. So yeah, that was tricky, but you know, it worked out pretty well, and I put a lot of work into it. So we were able to shoot pretty much what I wrote, and then there was some wiggle room. I told everybody, "Hey, I'm not precious about the script here, so they're all doing me a favor if they're interested enough to do the part, and then they have ideas and they want to put something into that performance. Of course, they're going to bring it more to life. So that just makes it better, which was nice.
Yeah. You know, we were talking about Woody Allen. The one problem that occasionally comes up now that he's stopped playing himself in his films, you'll have characters that sound like Woody Allen and other actors playing them. In this movie, you don't have that other than, of course, your character, Dimitri Martin as Dimitri Martin.
Right. My range is never going to be.
It's not Kevin Klein doing Dimitri Martin.
No, that'd be hilarious.
Yet it still has your voice.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. I think, you know, when I think about the scenarios and the general story, and then, yes, my character, I'm guessing if I get to make more movies, there's never going to be a too big a range for any character I play. But I can turn the dial a little bit. And this guy's maybe a little more introverted than I am. And, you know, he's kind of sad and he's an only child. And I'm not those things. I don't think of I know I'm not an only child. I don't think I'm sad. So it's a little different than me.
Yeah. You know, it's such a great movie. I loved it to death. And you have such a unique comedic voice. I swear, I just want to get inside your head like being John Malkovich and see the world through your eyes, Dimitri.
That'd be pretty boring, man.
I mean, before we go, I just wonder, what's the most interesting or curious observation you've made, let's say, in the past week or so about people or the world around you?
Oh, that's an interesting question.
Or something that was interesting to you.
Yeah, in the last week. Well, this was kind of interesting. It's going to be a very disappointing answer, but my wife, in our bathroom, you know, when you finish the toilet paper, there's like the tube from inside.
Yeah.
And there were like three of them on the shelf in the bathroom. And I was looking at that and I was like, oh, I could make binoculars out of that. This would be fun for my son. So I took them and I took one of them and I drew like semicircles on the ends, each end of it, and cut them out. And then it like fit snugly, the other two. And so then it held them together. So just using three toilet paper rolls, I made binoculars. And it kind of held together on its own. But then I took some like scotch tape and it taped it together.
You're the MacGyver of toilet paper.
Yeah, well,
tricks.
I made these binoculars for my son. I thought, hey, he's going to like this.
Yeah.
And my wife was like, did you take those toilet paper rolls? I was like, oh, yeah, why? She's like, they wanted those at the school for some project. They wanted us to do. I was like, oh, oops. She's like, oh, we'll get more. Yeah. We'll have more of them because, of course, we will because it's just cardboard garbage or whatever. But anyway, so yeah. I was excited. I was like, hey, I made binoculars. And I showed my wife and we looked through them. Hey, it works. And then I showed them to my son and he was just like.
Nonplussed.
Yeah, he's like, oh, okay. I mean, he's a sweet kid, but he was not. He didn't seem interested. I felt like I accomplished something.
Yeah, well, kids inspiring creativity, like we said.
Exactly.
Well, once again, Dean opens in theaters this Friday, June 2nd, and look for Dimitri Martin's new book of drawings coming out this fall. Dimitri, thanks for talking with me.
Thank you. Thanks a lot, man.
Well, I hope you enjoyed the show. A reminder, the Couchbase Engagement Database is the only database specifically designed to deliver brilliant customer experiences across all your web, mobile, and IoT apps. You get unparalleled agility, manageability, and performance at any scale, and your customers get continuously richer experiences. Learn more at couchbase.com/kickassnews. Thanks again to Dimitri Martin for coming on the podcast. His wonderful film, Dean, opens Friday, June 2nd. Check your local listings for theaters and showtimes. Follow Dimitri Martin on Twitter at Dimitri Martin. And for more information on everything Dimitri's up to, including his books, drawings, and live shows, visit live.dimitrimartin.com. Be sure to subscribe to Kick-Ass News on iTunes and leave us a review while you're there. Don't forget to take our listener survey. It only takes 5 minutes at podsurvey.com/kick. You can visit Kick-Ass News on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at Kick-Ass News Pod. And be sure to recommend Kick-Ass News to your friends on your social media. And if you really want to help out, then donate to our GoFundMe campaign at gofundme.com/kickassnews. Or click on the donate button at kickassnews.com. As always, I welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions at comments@kickassnews.com. For now, though, I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kick-Ass News. Kick-Ass News is a trademark of Mathis Entertainment, Inc.